Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for the quartet for the arrangement. That was a pretty arrangement and a good addition. In the year 1863, an American magazine by the name of the Atlantic Monthly ran an article. It was by an investigative journalist, and he started way back at the story's beginning, which was in 1807, not long after the Louisiana Purchase. And it appears that there was a man named Aaron Burr, Aaron Burr having been a former vice president of the United States. And Aaron Burr, now a private citizen, had gone west to what was then the western part of the United States, which would be New Orleans. And meeting with some British officials, he was accused later, including Thomas Jefferson, accusing him, the president, of trying to create and carve out a new country in the middle of the United States territory. It was so serious of a charge, and the evidence was there, that he was put on trial for treason, former vice president of the United States. But there was a young man in the army, who had fallen sway to the persuasive powers of Aaron Burr, whose name was Lieutenant Philip Nolan. And Lieutenant Nolan was also put on trial for treason. Of course, it was a military trial in his case. It was a court-martial. And because he was an accomplice, the same charge was brought. Now, during the questioning, it was done by a military tribunal, as I said, and the questioning went on for a long stretch of time in the afternoon. Some of the questions were real simple. Where were you born, Lieutenant Nolan? Answer, United States. Your youth was spent in Texas, was it not? Yes, I hunted horses there with my brother. You are charged with treason. Yet have you not been fed and given a uniform of the United States Army? Yes, sir. And have you not sworn on your faith to be true to it? Yes, sir. Yet as a citizen of the United States, would you not have obeyed any order signed by His Excellency Aaron Burr? No answer. Well, the trial dragged on and on, and all the while, Lieutenant Nolan had to stand, military trial, and he was getting fatigued, and the questions kept coming one after another. Finally, he was asked, have you, Lieutenant Nolan, anything that you wish to say to show that you have always been faithful to the United States? And the young Lieutenant Nolan's fatigue and youthful impetuousness came to the fore. And he shouted angrily, and I quote, damn the United States of America. I wish I may never hear of the United States again. Well, this was 1807. And those who were in the military tribunal trying him were shocked. Because, you see, not that many years before, they had fought with George Washington in the Revolutionary War. They didn't have a uniform. They didn't have boots. And they made it possible for this young man to have a country at all. So they retired to their chambers. Later they came out with a sentence. Lieutenant Nolan, your wish is never to hear of the United States again. You shall have your wish. And the judgment went up to the top command of the United States, came back down through the U.S. Secretary of the Navy, and Lieutenant Nolan was put on a ship in the Atlantic, an American ship, with the written instructions to the captain to never again set foot on the United States soil. But it went further. He was never to hear of the United States again. All of his newspaper articles, any magazines that he was to have contact with were to be censored beforehand. And if there was a mess hall and the troops were talking with each other and somebody happened to mention home and they realized Lieutenant Nolan was there, they all fell silent. He was to be given his uniform. He was to be given a normal officer's allotment of food and clothing. He was free to roam the ship, but never to set foot or hear of the United States again. Now, during this time, of course, the War of 1812 came along with the British. and the British were fighting the American warship, one of the ships that Lieutenant Nolan was on. And a direct shot from a British cannon hit the American cannon and obliterated most of the crew. Lieutenant Nolan had been in the military army, but he knew how to fire a cannon. So he grabbed what he could of the remaining crew, helped himself align the cannon, and proceeded to fire at the British ship for the remainder of the afternoon, saving the American ship. Well, the captain of the ship saw what he had done, recommended to the Secretary of Navy a commendation for Lieutenant Nolan that his sentence be commuted. But a single sentence came back down that this was not possible. And so Lieutenant Nolan lived the rest of his life, transferred from ship to ship, never seeing or hearing of the United States again. This happened for 50 years. Near the end of his life, he fell sick, and the ship's doctor came to talk to the ship's captain and says, "Lieutenant Nolan would like to see you." The ship's captain went to see Lieutenant Nolan, and Lieutenant Nolan, lying on a sick bed, white hair, knew his days were short, and begged the captain to tell him anything he could about home. And now the captain, feeling sympathetic for Lieutenant Nolan, knew the orders, but saw the condition of Lieutenant Nolan, decided to tell him anything he could about the United States. And so they had a most enjoyable conversation to catch up on 50 years' history of the United States. Now, the captain was surprised. Despite the censorship, despite the orders, little bits and pieces of information had gotten through Lieutenant Nolan, and it had whet his appetite for ever more information. He told the captain to go to the foot of his bed. The captain did, drew back a curtain, and there Lieutenant Nolan had drawn a hand map of what he thought the United States might presently look like. And he had the captain draw in on the map each state for the past 50 years that had been added to the United States of America. And again, as I said, they had an enjoyable conversation. One of the things they asked about, Lieutenant Nolan says, "Who is the President of the United States?" The captain says, "Well, a man named Abe Lincoln." "Is that the Lincoln from the family in New England?" "No. This Lincoln is a Kentuckian like yourself. He grew up the hard way. He's a common man." And so the questions went. Finally, Lieutenant Nolan was fatigued. The captain left. But before he left, Lieutenant Nolan said, "When I die, I want you to come back and look in my Bible." It wasn't shortly after that, but the medical doctor came to the ship's captain and said Lieutenant Nolan had passed. So the captain went and looked at Lieutenant Nolan, found his Bible on his chest, opened it up, and there was a piece of paper. And it said, "Bury me at sea, for it has become my home. But put up a marker in one of the states. And say to Lieutenant Nolan, no man loved his country more." Now, this article was written 50 years later in 1863. You know what was happening in the United States in 1863? We're smack in the middle of the Civil War. And the vision that the Founding Fathers had for the United States was being torn asunder by the war between the states and the division which had occurred. Men who read this article were so moved by the article that they end up joining in droves the Union Army to preserve the Union because they saw what happened in A Man Without a Country. Now, the title of the article was "The Man Without a Country." It's true that Aaron Burr was vice president. It's true that he went on trial. But Lieutenant Nolan never existed. He was a fictitious account written by the author, who was also anonymous. But it was such a powerful article that it became a great American short story. And I remember reading it when I was young, only I had the comic book version. This is the classic comic book version. There's Lieutenant Nolan fighting the British. I went on eBay and got this. I was so enthralled with the story still. But he became known as the Man Without a Country. Now, I chose this story to introduce what I believe can fairly be called in the Bible a man without a country. This was a man who was born when his mother was a slave. He was a military man who wrote his great accomplishment. And if you heard him, you might say, His speech was that of a stutterer. Yet, he became one of the world's best-known authors. As an adult, he couldn't wait to leave the country he was born in. He had another country in mind. He learned, like Lieutenant Nolan, everything he possibly could about that country, about its history, its geography, its legendary heroes. This man gave up everything he could to get to that country, but he died never having reached it. Now, if you haven't guessed already, the man, we know the man as Moses. What I would like to do with the time remaining is to go through a few occurrences in the life of Moses and see how they shaped him to become what we might call a man without a country. And along with it, I'd like to show how the experience of Moses is significant to us who are New Testament Christians. What do we know about Moses? Well, we know that he was born from a tribe of Levi. He was youngest of three children. He was spared being thrown into the Nile by Pharaoh's orders because, the text says, his mother saw that he was a beautiful baby. So she made the basket, hid him in the reeds, hoped that the crocodiles wouldn't get him, set his sister to watch them. It was God's time. 400 years earlier, God had made a promise to Abraham. Your descendants are going to go down into Egypt. They're going to become slaves. And 400 years from now, I'm going to bring judgment on Egypt. And I'm going to bring your children back here. Time was up. Here was a vessel. Here was a vehicle. I'm going to suggest that this man was either the sperm and the egg were selected, or he was selected shortly after his birth because of the interesting things that happened to him. Of course, Miriam said one day the princess, the Pharaoh's daughter, came down, spotted the basket, had the basket retrieved, opened the basket, and there was a beautiful baby crying. I'm going to guess, though I don't know for sure, God tickled her mind. You know, a normal woman, biological woman, seeing a beautiful baby crying its heart out is going to have empathy for it. This was a lady who apparently didn't have any children. Jewish tradition says she had leprosy. That's why she was down at the Nile in the first place, washing. At any rate, here's a baby crying. Miriam comes up. You want a nurse for her? Well, that's what you do when a baby's crying, right? You feed it. Calm it down. Perfect scenario. Yes, of course, and I'll pay her for it. So Moses' mother got to nurse her until he was weaned. How long that is, we're not sure. But we can fully, if you look, please, in Exodus 2:10, there's a single sentence that I think is helpful for us. This is Exodus chapter 2 and verse 10. I'll read the single sentence. It says, "And the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son." Important. This was a legal adoption. It was her son. Did Moses know he was adopted? Did he know his original father? Did he have any father? Did he have contact with his family? Did he know that he was a Hebrew? Now, when the Pharaoh's daughter opened the basket, she says, "That's a Hebrew baby." How did she know? Did he look different? Look different than the Egyptians? I have a brother who's adopted two children. One of them is from another race. And identity is very important to a child to raise them to know who they are. I have to imagine Moses had that question come to his mind more than once. Who am I? How did Moses see himself? How did others see him? He was, princess daughter raised in the palace. Was he a spoiled little rich boy? We can only ask these questions because we don't know. But we do know between the time he was a youth and the time he became an adult, something happened. Either a series of incidents or one big incident, we don't know. But I'd like you to look at Hebrews 11. because we find something remarkable in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 24. It says in Hebrews 11, 24, by faith Moses, when he was come to years, that means, I don't know if it was a late teenager, early 20s, but there's some form of maturity involved. When he had come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Now, any of you mothers who have children, who have sons or daughters, doesn't really matter. How would you like it? You're Pharaoh's daughter, and your son says, I refuse to call you mom. You're not my mom. I reject everything that you've had. This is what we're presented with. Choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. Why would a spoiled little rich boy, if I might borrow that phrase, ever want to choose to suffer with the slaves when he had all the goodies? Something or some series of things happen. Now, we can only guess. I've hinted at, did he look different? Did it start when the other Egyptian kids poked fun at him for being a stutterer? We don't know. We simply don't know. Now, some adopted children have absolutely no desire to meet their biological parents. Just another thought. It's no big deal. They know who their parents are. Adopted parents, that is. That's how happy. Others have an intense desire to seek out their biological parents. So much so that they'll spend thousands of dollars and decades fighting through sealed records to try to find their natural parents. What was Moses' orientation? He had an identity crisis at some point, didn't he? And my guess is God had this whole thing set up. He knew the young man was going to do that. And he was softening him up for the big deliverance that this man's job had to entail. Well, there's another defining moment, I believe, in Moses' life, found in Exodus chapter 2. This is found in Exodus chapter 2 and verse 11. It's a single sentence. It says, and it came to pass in those days, when Moses was grown, that he went out unto his brothers and looked on their burdens. We see two things here. Moses knew he was a Hebrew. Doesn't matter how he dressed him. Doesn't matter what school he went to. Didn't matter how his clothes were. He was a Hebrew. Secondly, he looked on their burdens. He now identified with the suffering they had. Not just content to be a Hebrew. He looked and empathized with their burdens. Who would you pick if you were God and want a great deliverer? You can already see the softening that God is working with this mind towards. Now, I worked for many years in the trucking business in Southern California. A lot of you know there are a lot of people of Hispanic background in Southern California, not all of them documented. One fellow I worked with became good friends with. His name was Eddie Medina. He grew up like I did, American schools, went into the United States Army, American citizen, didn't even speak Spanish. But in the trucking industry, there are a lot of undocumented workers there as well. You and I would not be able to tell the difference between them racially. But Eddie Medina could. And sometimes, in mocking or half seriousness, but half in jest, he would go, I'll smack you, you wetback. And they all knew it was a joke because a wetback was a derogatory term. But Eddie Medina did not identify with the undocumented aliens. He was an American. Moses identified with not even the undocumented alien, but with a slave. At least an undocumented alien earns a paycheck, doesn't he? But Moses identified with the slave. That was a choice that he made. I'd like you to look at the next incident that occurred in his life. This would be Exodus 2. And we're going to continue in verse 11, if I've got my notes right. When he went out to see his brethren under their burden, verse 11, it says, and he spied an Egyptian smiting a Hebrew, one of his brothers. And he looked this way and that way. And when he saw there was no man, he slew the Egyptian and buried him in the sand. Now, our Jewish friends will tell us additional background that sheds light on this incident. You see, it was likely that this Hebrew slave was taken out where nobody else could see him, because the overseer was going to give him a good baiting. Moses saw the beating of the man, and his life was placed in jeopardy. What did Moses do? Should he just walk on by, say, "Hey there, stop that"? Moses looked this way and that way, struck the man and killed him, buried the body. Now, Jews will tell us Moses did not commit murder. This is significant. There are laws in the Old Testament which explicitly permit an individual to go and secure the life of another individual who is under imminent attack from being murdered. Jews know this. Not a big problem. And they'll point out the Bible nowhere condemns Moses' action. Now, to help us understand this a bit, let's imagine a modern context. Let's say Moses was a German citizen in World War II. And as a German citizen, he worked in a concentration camp. And as one of his fellow German workers gets irritated at one of these scrawny little Jewish concentration camp occupants, grabs him, drags him around behind the barracks, and starts beating the living daylights out of him, to the point that if it continues, the concentration camp victim is going to die. And now our German Moses looks this way and that way and comes and strikes the German officer or the German worker. Is there any judicial power in the United States would find Moses guilty of murder? And as our Jewish friends tell us, especially a well-known one who teaches the Torah, God did not pick a murderer as a deliverer of Israel. Quite the opposite. He used the natural empathy that this man had already as a carnal man years later. This man was being softened and trained for it. Now, you know the rest of the story. Somebody saw it. Message got up to Pharaoh. In order to live, Moses goes into the desert. 40 years. At this point, there's no question. Moses is truly a man without a country. Now, you know the story. Sun comes up, sun comes down. Moses gets real acquainted with the desert, but he's going to need to be in years to come. But after 40 years, he sees the burning bush. God sends him back to Egypt. 10 plagues come, death of the firstborn. Israel goes out, crosses the Red Sea, gets the 10 commandments. 2 more years pass. 2 more years. And then we come to another defining moment in Moses' life. It's found in Numbers chapter 13. Numbers chapter 13 and verse 31. This is about the spies who were sent out to spy out the land and came back with their report. I'm going to read it in a modern translation. You know the story. 2 men came back and said, "Yes, it's a tough proposition, but look what God has done for us so far. We can do it." It's Joshua and Caleb. They had the faith it could be done. But the others said, "We can't attack those people. They're way stronger than we are." And they began to spread scary rumors among the people of Israel. They said, "We scouted out the land from one end to the other. It's huge. Why? We even saw the Nephilim giants. Alongside them, we felt like grasshoppers, and they looked down on us as if we were grasshoppers." Chapter 14. The whole community was in an uproar, wailing all night long. You haven't lived until you've seen Middle Easterners wail. All night long. All the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and the entire community was in on it. "Why didn't we die in Egypt? You know, at least we had graves in Egypt, right? Or in the desert. Why has God brought us to this country to kill us? Our wives and children are about to become plunder. Why don't we just go back to Egypt?" Verse 4, Soon they were all saying to one another, "Let's pick a new leader. Let's go back to Egypt." Now, you know the story. Joshua and Caleb try to dissuade them. But in verse 10, it says, the people said, "Let's stone them." And then we find God's judgment. He'd had it. You see, in 2 short years, there have been 10 rebellions. If God let them go into the promised land, what kind of country would it have become? Moses was gone 40 days and they were already worshiping the golden calf. And now they're going to go into a land filled with idols. Israel eventually, when they did enter the land, went because of idolatry. This would have been an absolute catastrophe. The promises to Abraham would have never been fulfilled. So the judgment of God was rather easy. "I'll wipe you out and I'll start over again." But Moses interceded, said no. But God still carried out the death penalty. He just did it more slowly. "All of you rebellious people over age 40, the ones I can't teach, you get the death penalty one day at a time for 40 years. But you see, God could teach the next generation. Here's this, he's got 40 years. Now he hasn't to teach a slave people anymore. He's teaching a teachable people isolated in the desert, away from idols, away from other things. So, however, what if you were Moses? You're 80 years old. You understand the whole purpose of your life. At some point it dawns on you that the reason you were spared, the reason you were in the basket, didn't get eaten by the crocodiles, the reason Pharaoh's daughter came and got you, the reason you spent 40 years in the desert preparatory to the great deliverance of Israel is because God was carrying out his promises to Abraham. And the whole thing, at age 80, he gets his prison sentence also. Now, if you're 80 years old and the judge says 40 years, that's probably how Moses felt. 40 years back in the desert, I'll be an old man. All of his life's purpose is being wiped out for things beyond his control. Now, there was one more incident I think is significant to Moses' life. If you look at it, it's found in Numbers 20, Numbers chapter 20. You'll remember the incident. In the desert, water is very, very, very important. You can't, when I had a chance to be there last summer, you count how long it's going to be before you can get another bottle of water. That's in a modern air-conditioned bus. I can tell you some stories another time, but water became the absolute most precious thing we could carry around. But the Israelites had no water. It was true they didn't. God didn't say, yes, they have water. No, they didn't have water. Cattle were bellowing, children crying, tugging at mom and dad, don't have water. How does it make you feel? Moses came to God, and God said, I'll tell you what you do. Speak to the rock. Get all the children of Israel around this big rock. Apparently there's some identifiable rock that they could all see. Speak to it, and I'll bring water out. Then comes the big problem. Numbers 20 and verse 10. And Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly together before the rock, and he said to them, you can hear a little bit of irritation in his voice. Hear now, you rebels, must we bring water for you out of this rock? Then Moses lifted his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod. Water didn't come out the first time. And the water came out abundantly, and the congregation and their animals drank. Now, there are several problems that happen here, or that are problematic. We'll just choose one. Next verse, verse 12. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, because you did not believe me to hallow me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them. Remember, said, must we bring water for you out of this rock? You know, already after he dies, we learn later that the devil disputed with the body of Moses. Why? Because, as in the earlier message, there would be a relic of Moses' body that people could worship. People still line up after Lenin's death in Russia to view the great liberator, Lenin. Imagine what the devil wanted to do with any part of Moses' body. But here's Moses playing into the whole scenario by elevating himself. Must we bring water from you out of this rock? The faith would be pointed in a very bad direction. It was a serious matter. But can you imagine if you're Moses, how crushed you would be? You already had to spend a prison sentence of 40 years in desert. You already saw your life's goals shrink. And now God points at you. You personally are not going to lead them in. He's 120. This has got to be personally devastating. But as much as that is, there's a bigger problem Moses has. And you say, what's bigger than that? Remember what happened 38 years before? They didn't go in. If Moses isn't going to be there, maybe they're not going to go in again. Maybe God destroys them all. Don't think this crossed Moses' mind? What's he going to do about it? Well, we have the Torah for a reason. It is true that God told Moses to write down the written laws that he gave them. Moses did more than that. You have in your lap 5 books. Why did Moses, from Moses' human point of view, include the others? Well, think about it. Let me try to answer that with a story. I had a friend who died a couple years back, about 5-6 years ago now, died of cancer in his 50s. He had 3 young children. We went to visit him before he died. He was a voracious reader, had shelves and shelves of books, but I noticed something different about the shelves of books. He had inside of them a sheet of paper. And I looked at them. And on the sheet of paper and in front of the book, he told what the book was about. And then in different places through the book, he had these little post-it sticky notes. And I opened and looked at some of them. In his handwriting, in Dad's handwriting, why this page was important, why this book was important. Do you realize what he was doing? This dad knew he wasn't going to be there for these 3 kids. He didn't want them to have all the suffering and no benefit of his life. Moses knows he's not going to be there. What if they flake out? So he goes back and begins to give a historical legacy to this people without a country. A slave people. Where they came from, where they were going, why they had the right to the land. I had an instructor teach me this decades ago when we were in Israel, Church of God instructor, and it changes the way you look at the first 5 books of the Bible. Sure, God preserved it. If Moses didn't know, he could always go talk with God face to face and get the information. But he wrote it down for a very specific reason for his day and time. Now, to demonstrate this, I'd like to look at a couple scriptures. They're rather fascinating. You realize, of course, that nobody else could do this. Moses was now 120. And how old the oldest Israelite was? Except for Joshua and Caleb. The oldest Israelite would be 60 years old. Moses is twice that age. He's the only one who can do this. Genesis 9. Moses has to pick something to write about. Meaningful to these desert people. Look at Genesis 9, what he chooses to write. This is a story of Noah on this side of the flood. Noah gets a hankering for hard alcohol, actually wine in those days. And he planted a vineyard, got drunk. He's in his tent, naked. You know, you think a 500-year-old man would have learned something by now not to be like that. And then we find out that his son, Ham, younger son, did something to him. How do we know? Well, verse 24 tells us. So Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his younger son had done to him. Moses is picking this story for a reason. What was it that he did? We don't know. There are 2 theories floating around the Church of God I'd like to present today. First one is that his younger son, Ham, perpetrated an unnatural sexual act upon him. Second one, which I lean toward more, finds its answer this way. The earth had been destroyed. There's only a few people left, 3 sons. And if they're anything like young men today, they're going to divide up the Monopoly game. They're going to divide up the wrist board. Well, these guys get to divide up the earth. but God is telling them to multiply. And this theory says that Noah and his wife are contemplating having more children. Well, more children means smaller pieces of the pie. So at an opportune moment, the younger son, Ham, goes and castrates his father. No more children. Why is this significant? We'll come to it. Noah places a curse, but notice who he places it on. Does he place it on the man who did the dirty deed? He doesn't. What's going on? Verse 25, Moses' curse. Then Moses said, "Cursed be Canaan. A servant of servants shall he be to his brothers." And he said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and may Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth," that's his third son, "and may he dwell in the tents of Shem, and may Canaan be his servant." What did Canaan do? The curse that's on Canaan is significant because why is Moses bringing this up? The children of Israel are going to go into whose land? Canaan's land. You desert people, don't you know? Can't you read? Please understand. Canaan is meant to be under a curse. What's a curse? A servant of servants. Don't chicken out next time you go to the land. Next time you go up to the land, you have a moral and legal right to that land. Don't you know the prophecy of God? The Canaanites are to be servant of servants. That's why Moses chose this story of Noah, to give encouragement and a legacy for this people without a country. Now, another issue, another story that Moses had to choose to tell. This one's found in Genesis 23. The context here is a little incident. It seems like almost nothing. But it's about Abraham and his wife Sarah. Sarah died. They were married a long time. Abraham is a stranger in the land. He just can't go bury his wife in somebody's backyard. So he wants to buy a plot of ground. Moses picks this story. See if you can figure it out why we're going through it. Genesis 23, chapter 14. "And Ephron answered Abraham, saying to him, 'My Lord, listen to me. The land is worth 400 shekels of silver. Well, what's that between you and me? So bury your dead.' And Abraham listened to Ephron, and Abraham weighed out the silver for Ephron, which he had named in the hearing of the sons of Heth." Let me stop here. What's going on is a legal transaction. You have legal eyewitnesses. Moses notes this. A legal transaction is taking place in the hearing of the sons of Heth. 400 shekels of silver, the currency of merchants. So the field of Ephron, which was in Machpelah, which was before Mamre, the field and the cave which was in it, and all the trees that were in the field, which were within the surrounding borders, were deeded, catch the word deeded, to Abraham as a possession. In the presence of the sons of Heth, before all who went in at the gate of the city. The phrase gate of the city is significant. That's the legal courthouse. That's where all the business was transaction. So what we're seeing here is in front of witnesses, a deed is being transferred from one party to the other. Moses picks this story. Verse 20. "So the field and the cave that is in it were deeded to Abraham and the sons by the sons of Heth as property for a burial place." Why would Moses choose this story? A 400-year-old incidental story. Well, I'd like to explain it with a story. In 1967, for those of you who might remember, there was the Arab-Israeli war in the Middle East called the Six-Day War. There were no video cameras in those days. You turn the TV on, you get a live session of the United Nations Security Council meeting. And up rose the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations, a man named Dr. Abba Iban. He was born in South Africa, educated in England. He was a linguist. A more eloquent man one will never hear. Abba Iban was addressing the question that always comes up in the Middle East: does Israel have a right to this land in the first place? Abba Iban stood up, opened the book that we just read, about Abraham paying for the land and getting the deed. Do you realize what Abba Ibn was doing? He was making the identical argument that Moses was making to the desert people 3,500 years before. You have a right to this land, Israel. Didn't your forebear, Abraham, buy part of this land? No, he didn't buy the whole thing. But it's a legal claim to the land. And when Moses is dead and gone, the people have a historical document and a moral and legal right and legacy to have access to that land and have no one tell them that they can't. Now, I began this message by saying that Moses' example of being without a country had significance to us in the New Testament. Why don't you consider a theme with me for a moment? It appears that all the patriarchs were made to move. They had to leave home. They had to leave their country at one time or another. Noah not only left a country, he left a world behind. We're going to look at Abraham in Hebrews 11 to close. Because Abraham was the quintessential example of this. In Hebrews 11, and we'll begin in verse 9, about which country did Abraham really look for? We'll start in Hebrews 11, verse 9. By faith, Abraham dwelt in the land of promise as in a foreign country. It wasn't his country, he knew that. Dwelling in the tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs of him with the same promise, for he waited for a city which has foundations, whose builder and maker was God. Abraham knew the end of the story. It wasn't just the land of Canaan. Abraham saw way out there what you and I see. There is a city coming down from God. Abraham's eye was fixed on it. And the writer of Hebrews is telling Christians with a Jewish background who understood this, Abraham is looking for the same city that you are looking for. Now, verse 12. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them and embraced them and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. They knew their inheritance. Their country was not on the earth. Verse 16. But now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city. If you're what we call a first-generation Christian, and you tell your stories to one another, your lives had to be moved, didn't they? This country you came to found out wasn't where your real citizenship was. It was in heaven, Paul says. But you've left family. You've left job. You've left friends. Just like the patriarchs had to do. God's calling of you is, in that sense, no different. That is a constant theme in the Bible. Why? The eye is on a different country, on a heavenly country. That's the legacy that we have, not the land of Canaan. When I was 17, I came into contact with the literature of the Church of God. And despite my wanting to see the hints of the New Testament Christian Sabbath day, it became pretty clear after a while. I remember getting the booklet, Which Day is the Christian Sabbath? And I was scared of what it might say. I had a feeling what it would say. I took it. And I put it under a whole pile of Plain Truth magazines because I didn't want to read it. I was 17, working in my father's farm. And one day, I said, I'm going to read the book. And I was cut to the heart. It was worse than I'd imagined. There was no room for anything other than a Sabbath being on Saturday. Now what was I going to do? So I found a way to hint around to my mother that about the Sabbath, and maybe I might like to do that. Well, I got no uncertain answer. You will not and live in this house can keep a Sabbath. What was a 17-year-old supposed to do? I didn't even have a high school diploma. So I didn't keep a Sabbath that summer. Worked at my dad's farm. I hated every Saturday and every Sunday. Sunday we had to go to church, and on Sabbath I was out working, breaking the Sabbath. I never want a guilty conscience like that again. Finally, in the autumn, I got down in the low spot of the field where no neighbors could see me on a tractor. And there was the sun almost setting in the afternoon. I felt miserable all day. I finally got down in the dirt and I said, okay, God, I'm going to keep a Sabbath day. I know I'm going to get kicked out of the house. And frankly, I don't even want to do this. I didn't want to learn about this Sabbath. I don't have a high school degree. You're going to have to take care of me. So I was prepared. First night I was going to spend in the hay barn on my parents' farm. Second night at my grandparents' house, and after that I had no idea where I would spend. I can identify a little bit with Moses, some of these patriarchs, just as you can with things that have happened in your life. Now, as it happened in my case, they saw my seriousness, and I was a firstborn. They didn't want to screw up raising a firstborn, so maybe it's a phase the kid's going through. So they backed off a little bit. But it was uncomfortable for many years because of the division that occurred. It was real clear that I wasn't in the family like I was before. It was like being in a different country, I suppose. Now, if you have parents in the church, if you grew up in the church, you've had a similar experience. When Christmas comes around, and the other kids start showing or telling what things they got for Christmas, you got something for Christmas. Right? You were embarrassed. How can I get out of this arrangement? And when Saturday or Friday night comes around, you know that you're different. You can't fit in. It feels like, it might be said, you're a different country. That's fair. You can identify with that. And when you go to the feast, you're surely different. There's one little Indian kid where one of my daughters went to school with, and he wanted to know what those days of 11 bread were. What's 11 bread? Well, the Israelites, if they were lucky, had the legacy of Moses, 5 books. We have the 5 books. You got it on your lap. We got more than that. We have the Psalms of David. We have the writings of the prophets. We have the eyewitness accounts of the life of Christ. We have the letters of the apostles. In each one of them, they're pointing to a country, the kingdom of God. We understand it better than any of them do. And there is a time coming when that country is coming down from heaven. One that everyone that has the Holy Spirit will be granted an entrance abundantly. And when that event happens, the one that was pointed out by Moses and Noah way up to the apostles, when that event happens, never again will the people of God be said to be a people without a country.